Danny C. and Wesley L. coming straight from Dude Division on Outside the Loop Radio, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Dude Division, that was last week. Summer is in full swing, and I'm here for it. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. This is show number 1025, and what we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. The wonderful Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN Radio studio. And yep, here we are in summertime. School is done. Love that. And let's talk about the show today because it's a good one. You know, last week it was Dude Division, but also the Illinois General Assembly. They were making this mad dash to finish up before they had to adjourn. And I know the Bears, right? That got all the coverage or the lack of action with the Bears. So we'll talk about some housing issues that were before the Illinois General Assembly. We'll see where those housing bills went. Also, we will meet someone, get this, who is attempting to eat at every restaurant inside the loop, which is very meta because this show is outside the loop. We'll talk to someone who is going to every restaurant in the loop and putting those reviews on his Substack and street vendors. I love street vendors. I hope you do too, because they are hardworking people. They have a really good product. And I'm thinking of the elote. If you've never had an elote, go to a street vendor in Chicago and get one immediately. Corn on the cob, usually on a charcoal grill, covered in this mayo creamy kind of sauce with some spices drizzled on top of there and cheese. And it's so good. Highly recommend it. And the street vendors are going through some tough times right now when it comes to law enforcement. So we'll talk to someone from the Street Vendors Association of Chicago. It's all coming up on the show today. I'm glad you are here. And now I'm thinking about elotes. Two things that really make me happy: Chicago and good food. Luckily, there is a massive overlap in that Venn diagram. There is so much good food in Chicago, so anytime I can talk about it publicly, I'm a happy man. Nick Kindlesberger is a former Chicago Tribune food critic, former editor of Serious Eats Chicago, and now he is the creator of a new-ish food journalism project through Substack, and he is here with us today to tell us all about it. Nick, welcome back to the show. It's been a little while.
It has. It's so good to be back on the show.
It's great to have you here. So I said you were at the Trib. Times are what they are. So now you're kind of going out there on your own, and your latest project on Substack. And I love this because here you are on this show called Outside the Loop, and your project is called Nick in the Loop. Very meta or something.
Yeah, I'm glad we're addressing this early on because it's very important.
It's like this, the space-time continuum is going to explode or something. So, Nick, tell us about what you've set out to do here and where this idea came from.
Yeah, I was at the Tribune for many years, and I think I was best known for writing about places in every neighborhood of Chicago. I think I've been in every neighborhood of Chicago looking for restaurants and most of the suburbs outside. But I left the Tribune, and then I was working downtown, and then my daughter was in ballet classes downtown too, and on State Street, and we were down there five nights a week. So I found myself in the loop quite often. And I realized no one had been writing about the loop. And I thought it would actually be kind of an interesting, it would be an interesting idea to focus on the very granular. So instead of saying, oh, I can cover all of Chicagoland, what would it be like if I just covered the loop? and only those restaurants. And I tried to go to every single one of them. So that was sort of the impetus of the idea.
And you started this at the end of, or towards the end, I should say, of 2025. I think it was around October. And you've been doing these weekly posts on Substack. And to think about the Loop, you know, this is, I think it's just like a little bit of history here. I know you are also interested in history. We've talked about that before, and there's an intersection there with food, but that area of the Loop and the area that we're really talking about, because people debate, where is the Loop? Where does it end? And we're thinking, 100%. Yeah, we're thinking the river on the north and the west, Ida B. Wells Drive on the south, and Michigan Avenue on the east, thereabouts.
That's my preferred definition. So I appreciate that you have that as well.
I think that's accurate, though. But look, that area has gone through a lot over the years. And sure, there are a lot of offices and there are business and financial districts there. But it's interesting because, you know, sometimes, or most of the time, I would say, at 5 o'clock, everyone leaves that area, or a lot of people leave that area and they go to somewhere else to, you know, go home. And the restaurants that are there maybe have a day clientele, but are you finding that the Loop is becoming more of a food destination?
That's a great question. I think sort of is the answer. More people actually live in the Loop now than almost ever have. For, you know, 100 years, it's been the central business district of Chicago without many residents. And part of that is changing as more people are moving to the Loop. So there's more nighttime options. Of course, 100 years ago, the Loop was the destination for people in Chicago for nightlife.
Right.
And so I love looking up the history of the Loop because it's just fascinating.
Yeah.
But that used to be where everyone went out to eat. And that's definitely changed. And I don't think that it's anywhere close to, it doesn't have anywhere close to the cachet of a place like River North or the West Loop. But it is weird. And I love that about it. You can find things that are just nowhere else in the city. And so whether it's a place that's owned by, you know, an old couple that have just been doing it for 30 years and they only are open for lunch, or it's a bar that, you know, gets slammed for 2 hours and then it just totally is dead for the rest of the night. You know, there's a lot of stories there that I think people haven't been telling. And I think that people were trying to get out around the city and tell more of those stories because people had been ignoring those neighborhoods as well. But I think that the Loop is ripe for picking, and it's been so much fun to focus on that. And so I think if we're thinking about the directions of the Loop, if you look toward the east, you'll find more restaurants that are open for dinner and that are perhaps a place you'd want to go on a date. And then the further west you go is more of the lunchtime crowd.
So you mentioned that you're doing this Substack. Again, it's called Nick in the Loop. You're focusing on the Loop here. You're trying to, just like you did going to every neighborhood in Chicago to try the cuisine, you're trying to go to every restaurant in the Loop. How is the progress going?
I thought this wouldn't take that long, and it's going to take so much longer than I thought. So I'm kind of ignoring all of the chains. We all know the chains that are down there, your Potbellies, your Chipotles, but still it just never ends. And new places keep opening up. There's Fatback Deli that just opened up a few weeks ago. Then there's a new place along State Street. And so I think people are starting to move downtown again. When I was at the Tribune, I wrote about the what to eat in the Loop a few times. And by 2019, it was pretty impressive. And then the pandemic really took the wind out of the Loop. And there's still a lot of vacant storefronts. And so there's still a lot of work to be done. So I'm not trying to say that this is like the best neighborhood to go out and eat. But I'm just impressed by the depth of it and how younger people are coming in and trying, you know, interesting projects.
And one of the recent posts that you have specifically is about the Riverwalk. And I got to be honest, you know, when I think about going out to eat downtown, even in the Loop, I don't think about the Riverwalk. But you come out here and you're just making the argument that the Riverwalk is a civic treasure, which I would agree with. I mean, it's the beautiful views you have there. It is just amazing. But it's a place where we can get some good food.
Sort of, you know, as I mentioned in the article, the majority of the food is expensive and it's average. And you know what? That's fine. It's the Riverwalk. It's one of the most beautiful places to walk in the country. I don't want to like sell this, like puff this up too much, but it's really gorgeous.
Yeah.
Whenever I take people down there, they're just like, I can't believe this is here. The views are stunning. It helps if it's warm and it's not February, obviously.
Right.
But I was surprised by a couple places. Number one was Hare's Gulf Shrimp. So I have been looking for fried shrimp in Chicago for years. And my favorite place was Hare's on the south side. And so I was a bit stunned that they have a little shop on the Riverwalk. Once again, it's not cheap because you're on the Riverwalk. But you can get probably the best fried shrimp in the vicinity at this place. And so you can get a table, look out at the river. You might, you know, you can look towards the Trump Tower if you want to, or the new Tribune renovated tower to your right, and enjoy some of the best fried shrimp there is.
That's amazing. So I know Hare's, you know, just from being here a while, but I didn't even know that they had a Riverwalk situation going. What's another spot that you really liked on the Riverwalk?
I really like the Northmen. So this is they basically created a beer garden. And so when you think about the Riverwalk, the further west you go, the busier it is, the more likely you'll need a reservation. But if you go east, and for this part, we're going to kind of admit that we walk a little bit out of what is technically my definition of the Loop, though it is the city's definition of the Loop. And so it's east of Michigan, and there are just, you know, dozens of tables. So there's plenty of places to sit. They have a great beer selection and their own cider that they have contracted. And then you can get definitely the best Chicago dog on the Riverwalk there. And you don't have to wait in line. You don't have to make a reservation. It's such a satisfying place to just chill out for a few hours.
And again, with all these, the view is just amazing. So that helps.
Yes. It is. It's crazy. And, you know, it's astonishing that we're so in love with the Chicago River, because that was not the case a while ago. It was not a place you wanted to hang out next to.
Right.
So I just love that we've reclaimed this waterway and are turning it into a major attraction.
So this is all on your Substack. Again, it's called Nick in the Loop. And Nick, before I let you go, I want to ask you about journalism here. You love journalism. Yeah. I love journalism. You were professionally in it for so long. And I guess you still are now, even though you're kind of on your own. But when it comes to food journalism in Chicago and Chicagoland, I know there have been cuts, but how are we doing overall when it comes to that?
There have been a lot of cuts, and I don't know if we have the answer right now, but I think we're working towards something that's different. I left the Tribune because I realized that the old school, you know, food section was kind of done. When I started at the Tribune, we had, you know, 8 to 10 people in our department. And when I left, we were down to 2, and now there's 1 person.
Wow.
And I knew that was happening. And so I knew I wanted to get out while I could, because it's just, you know, the economic model isn't there anymore. I don't want to say Substack is the answer. It's probably one of the answers. I think that people are still looking for what makes the most sense. You know, the problem with Substack, as much as I like it, is that you would have to subscribe to multiple different places.
Right.
And so to get the full coverage you need. So I hope that we can figure something out that is more, that makes sense economically for people, so they are excited to join it. but then also is able to provide robust coverage, which is slipping at sort of mainstream publications just because of so many cuts. But it's a really tough thing because the interest in food hasn't waned, right?
Right.
People are more interested than ever. And so we're in a weird spot right now. It's a transition time, as they say.
Well, I hope it all works out because we need it. We need journalism just on a broad scale here, but also when it comes to food journalism, because we like to know what's going on with our food scene here in Chicagoland. And I know, Nick, you will continue to do that right now on this project, Nick in the Loop. Again, it's on Substack. And do you have a timeline? You're trying to go to every restaurant in the loop. Do you have an idea of when you might be done with this?
It's going to be at least another year, but places keep opening. And so my schedule keeps getting pushed back. So hopefully it gets pushed back indefinitely, but eventually I'll hopefully get a sense of it. You know, we'll see.
All right. We will see. Well, Nick Kindlesberger, former Chicago Tribune food critic, and he is the creator of his Substack, Nick in the Loop, it's called. We can go to substack.com. In fact, we can go to nickintheloop.substack.com to subscribe. Nick, it's been great catching up with you, man. Keep it up. I'm excited to see where you go next in the loop.
Thanks so much. And I really appreciate you, all that you're doing around the city as well. It's good to see we're still covering it the best we can.
Street vendors are part of the cultural fabric of Chicago. Across the city, street vendors, many of them immigrants and asylum seekers, rely on selling food and goods as a way to support their families and survive financially. But as recent enforcement efforts have intensified, many vendors have faced arrests, fines, and confiscation of their carts and merchandise. This topic raises important issues like the role of the city in regulating public spaces and how working people persevere despite facing obstacles when trying to make ends meet. Maria Orozco is the development manager and outreach coordinator at Street Vendors Association of Chicago. That's a local organization that organizes street vendors to build political and economic power. They are online at streetvendorsac.org. Maria is here with us today to talk about this issue. Maria, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me today.
It's great to have you here. So street vending in Chicago, let's just put it out there, it's legal. And as it stands right now, can you give us a sense of what the process is like to obtain a street vending license from the city?
Yes, so it is legal in some aspects where it has to be with packaged goods. So right now, the city hasn't given us the full on it's legal to sell prepared food on the street. So we do it at risk. And to obtain a license, which is either a peddler's license, you have to, majority of the people come to our organization for help because it is a very long process. They do have to get their either if they have a social or if they don't have a social, they need an I-10 number. And then after an I-10 number, then they need their EIN number. If they're going to be selling tamales, which are prepackaged, not in the corn husk, they don't consider that package prepackaged. They have to have it in a separate bag. Then you have to get your kitchen manager. You have to get your sanitation's license and so many more requirements. And the issue sometimes that we have is that the process can take up to 6 to 7 months. And some people don't really have that time to just not be able to sell or work because they need to sustain their families.
You know, it's the process is long here. It is something to think about. And because of that, folks are turning to just getting out there and being street vendors, like you say, as a way to make money for their families. And they're not obtaining that license. And this isn't new. This has been going on for a while. Historically, though, the city really hasn't been as aggressive in its enforcement of vendors as it is recently. Can you give us some details about what's happening in recent weeks here with the kind of ramp up in enforcement? What does that look like?
Yeah, so unfortunately, a lot of our vendors have been arrested lately. They haven't been, it's been something that hasn't happened in a very, very long time, in years, I want to say. And in the recent weeks, they have been arrested because they are selling in the downtown area, Millennium Park. And some of them have been given fines up to the minimum fine for these, for vending is $200, but then also it can go up to $500 per ticket. And sometimes in one ticket, they give you two different counts. So that could go up to $1,000 real quick, plus a $40 court fee that they charge you every time you go. And this time they're arresting them. They're sending them to court where they normally go to in Superior Street. But now they're sending them elsewhere, which they are kind of scared because there has been ICE in that area and in specifically that court area.
So do we know why this is happening? I mean, the enforcement is definitely ramping up. And as we're talking about, it hasn't looked like this in a long time. Why is this happening now?
We're not sure. We haven't gotten a clear answer. We don't know if it's the residents that are complaining that they don't want vendors in the city. We get it. It's a no peddling zone. And we've tried to communicate this with street vendors. And we always get the same response that it's something that there, it's a big tourist area. So a lot of people go there. So that's the only place where they can make more money than any part of the city. And it's really hard right now. But they haven't given us answers as to why this is happening or why they're being arrested. And we haven't gotten any direct answer regarding this and if it's going to stop. We are working on passing a new ordinance where our vendors are able to prepare their food in front of the clients, put mayo and butter in the corn without getting fined for it. But they will be having some restrictions as this, they can't sell in the downtown area. So like I said, maybe it's because some tenants are complaining. We have some people, we have videos of people racially profiling our vendors saying that they're going to call ICE on them. We don't know if it's owners from the buildings in Michigan Avenue. It's just a lot of different things that take place into this, and who makes those calls, we aren't sure yet.
You mentioned an ordinance, this proposed ordinance. Back in 2019, Mayor Lightfoot proposed an ordinance that would provide more legal protections for street vendors. So what's the status of this ordinance and what would that do? Is that so, the, like you say, they could actually prepare food in front of people on their carts?
Yes. So this ordinance that we are trying to pass, it's for our vendors to stop getting fined because they're getting fined for putting toppings in their elotes. If you have a mango that you want to cut up in front of your client, they're not allowing you to do that. So it gives you the opportunity and the leniency to cut fruit in front of them. The only thing that this license does not allow is raw food. For you to, so the meat has to be pre-cooked in a shared kitchen.
The human toll of all this, you know, we were talking about the ramping up of this enforcement and many people, as I said before, in the street vendors scene are immigrants, they're asylum seekers. Can you give us a sense of the human toll? Because these are people, these are working people trying to provide for their families. And, you know, I think on one hand, you hear people say, well, you should follow the law. But on the other hand, you know, they're helping us. They're doing us a service and they're trying to provide for their own families in the process. Can you give us a sense of that human toll here?
Yeah. And I have seen so many of the comments. I try to stay away from the comments that people make on reports about all of this because people can get really ugly.
Yeah.
And it could be a real mental toll on you as a person. And I come from street vendors. I am a street vendor and I work as a street vendor with my mom on the weekends when I'm not doing this full time. And she's out there. She's still out there doing it. My sister's her full-time employee and they work together. And my mom put me through college for that. You know, she was able to pay for my community college back when I was 19, 20. And my dad does it as well. He has his set job, but he also does it on the weekends or when he doesn't work for half of the year, he does it full time. And I've seen it firsthand and the struggle that it is and so much hard work. No one's going to want to wake up at 3-4 in the morning to cook tamales, to go out at 5 in the morning. And you see these comments where people say, oh, well, if license weren't required, then I'll go outside and sell hot dogs. And that's not true. People don't have that in them to do that. Because at first, for me, I was younger in high school. I was a little embarrassed at first. But then you think about it, you're like, this is a job. This is our business. And this is what's putting food on the table. And a lot of the vendors see it that way, that this is something, it's hard for them, especially in the immigration community, to try to get a job with all these restrictions of you need a social security, you can't use an I-10 to get a job. It's really hard. And for them to try to still have a small business and try to pay taxes, because in order for you to have a license, you need to pay taxes. And majority of our vendors do have some type of license just so they can have the ability to pay their taxes or to do something the right way. Even though the license doesn't tell you you can cut through with it, they still have some type of license so they can do something the right way. Maybe it's not the way that it's explained in the ordinance or in the license that they have, but they try to do what they can in a good way without stealing from anyone, without robbing anyone, without killing anyone. They're doing things the right way or the best way that they could.
Through the Street Vendors Association of Chicago, how are you working to change things? I know we've been talking about this proposed ordinance. Are you at City Hall? Are you talking to older people about how to change the rules or update them at least?
Yes, we do have some elder people that are on our side. We haven't talked to many. We do have every 2 weeks or monthly meetings with people from the city, and they help us understand a little bit more about the ordinance and what we want and what they are trying to enforce at times. So there is that communication where we are pushing for this to move this year. And we're also trying to see if we can make changes to the current ordinance. There's not a lot of people or at all many people that speak Spanish over there for our vendors. So sometimes the first time that I was able to go, we had 5 vendors trying to get licensing, and I was running back and forth trying to translate for all 5 of them. Mm. So that could be a big setback for us as well.
Well, I think this is a human story. I mean, these people in the street vendor community are doing everything that we say as a society you should do. Get out there, hard work, you know, make your business. And in doing so, you're helping people, you're satisfying people because they're getting something in return. And I think that there's a huge human cost here that we just have to think about. And sometimes when we talk about an issue like this, we kind of lose sight of that. So I really appreciate, Maria, your perspective and all of the hard work going on at the Street Vendors Association of Chicago. We could check out that organization online, streetvendorsac.org. Maria Orozco is the development manager and outreach coordinator at the Street Vendors Association of Chicago. Maria, thank you so much for all of your work for so many people and for talking to us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you and all your listeners.
There is an affordable housing crisis in the United States right now, and we are seeing the impacts of this in Illinois. The state is currently short about 142,000 housing units, and experts estimate that over 225,000 new homes need to be built in the next 5 years just to keep pace with demand. Recently in Springfield, Lawmakers were debating legislation that would beef up state municipal requirements to offer affordable housing to residents. Alex Nitkin is an investigative reporter at the Illinois Answers Project. That's a nonpartisan independent news organization published by the Better Government Association. And he has an update on the debate around affordable housing in our state. We can check out IllinoisAnswers.org. Alex, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great. It's nice to talk to you again. So let's talk about affordable housing. I said that there is a crisis here. So I want to talk about some of that context, the background, because there are some things that the state has tried to do over the years to improve affordable housing opportunities. So can you tell us about, at the outset here, this law that was originally designed to fight segregation? It's called the Affordable Housing Planning and Appeal Act. Well, what is this law about? Because this has been on the books for a number of years now.
Yeah, it's been the law since 2003. And honestly, until a couple months ago, I didn't even realize that it was a thing. It's pretty under the radar. Essentially, the idea behind APA, the Affordable Housing Planning and Appeal Act, is that the state is requiring that all municipalities around the state that have little or no affordable housing, basically think of all the wealthy suburbs, mostly, you know, to the north and northwest of Chicago, that they have to do something, that they have to create some kind of minimal plan to allow for the construction of affordable housing in their neighborhoods because of basically the situation that we've seen where they can use local zoning controls just to say, you know, you can only build a giant house here. And so functionally what that means is that you can only live in this town if you are really, really wealthy, if you can buy a big single family home. And so what APA does is that it tasks Illinois state housing regulators with sort of coming up with this list of unaffordable towns across the state. It's currently 44 of them, names that would not surprise you, you know, places like Kenilworth and Barrington, and requires them to write plans for how they're going to allow more affordable housing over time in their communities. And it also sets up an appeal system so that if those municipalities, if those towns don't submit plans that are compliant with what the state requires, then developers can file an appeal and basically bypass all of that local resistance and get their project built anyway. The problem is that, as we say in the story that we wrote about it last week, enforcement has been basically non-existent and compliance has been really spotty.
Yeah, I mean, I took that away from what you wrote, that really a lot of the municipalities just aren't complying with this law. And you go into that and you say, you report this, that essentially what is on the books, and someone says this in your story, is relatively toothless. Like the law doesn't really have any sort of power when it comes to making these municipalities kind of play ball here. So really, it's not it's very loosey-goosey, I guess you could say.
Yeah, that's one way that you could say it. I mean, that they have these requirements by state law to submit these plans outlining some actions that they can take, either land that they can identify where they can invite, you know, multifamily, you know, apartment building developers to apply or things like that, or incentives that they can provide. And of the 44 municipalities that they do this count on a five-year cycle every 5 years. About roughly a third of them submitted plans that were deemed compliant by state regulators. About another third or so submitted plans that state regulators did not accept. They said, no, you got to go back. That's not good enough. You got to go back and be more specific about what you're going to do. And the rest just never even bothered to submit plans at all. And this is for the last 3 years that this cycle has been underway. And so that really shows what these municipalities kind of think about this current law and what they think about generally the idea of them having an obligation to the state or to the region to provide some affordable options.
So what's the pushback been here? Because you go on to talk about this, that the mayors of these areas, these municipalities, these towns that are doing really well economically, and the price of housing is very expensive. What are some of the complaints they have in terms of the state trying to regulate what they're trying to do here with zoning?
Well, there are complaints that are very similar to the pushback that we've seen broadly to the governor's build plan and all of these sort of pro housing production plans that the governor tried and failed thus far to get through the legislature, which is essentially we as localities want the ability to regulate what gets built and what doesn't get built, what they say and what the mayor of Burr Ridge, which is what sort of a wealthy suburb mayor who we talked to, Garrett Grasso, said, the people of our town need to have the ability, need to have the right to petition their government and say what they want and what they don't want to get built in their community. And it's something that a lot of people just, this is not a local thing or a state thing, this is all over the country. People, a lot of especially homeowners, believe that they just have this right to get to veto new development in their towns. And they sort of view that as the democratic process, and what mayors say, that's the democratic process, they need to get that control. But of course, the consequences of that is that there are entire regions where if you are not wealthy, you just cannot live, period. If you are working at a restaurant or a hotel in those towns, you cannot afford to live in those towns. And that's the reality that that system is constructed. And that's where a lot of these efforts at statewide regulation come from.
So the mayors might say, hey, look, our residents are saying we moved to this area because we want to have this kind of lifestyle, we want to have this kind of environment, and we should have a say in that as taxpayers, as residents of these areas. And if we don't want affordable housing, then hey, we don't want affordable housing. That's how it should be. So with that as the background here, let's talk about what was being debated. So the idea here was that this Affordable Housing Planning and Appeal Act would get a little bit more power, that this would be honed to specifically address a few things. What was the proposed legislation that would increase the power of this already existing law?
Yeah, it would do three things. The first thing that it would do broadly is that it would widen the application. So instead of applying to towns where less than 10% of housing is deemed affordable, it would apply to towns where less than 25% of housing is deemed affordable. So it would roughly double the number of towns where it would apply, from like 45 to 90-ish. The second thing that it would do is it would add more specific requirements for what details they have to include in their plans when the towns submit these plans to state regulators, saying here is exactly what we're going to try to do and when we're going to do it to try to attract or at least lay the groundwork for the construction of more housing that would be more affordable to more people. And the third thing that it would do crucially is it would make it easier for either developers or affordable housing advocates or even would-be tenants of multifamily developments to trigger this statewide appeals process to bypass local resistance in non-compliant towns. And like we mentioned, it's never really been enforced, and no one has ever, as of yet, in 23 years that this law has been on the books, no one has ever filed an appeal through this. It's called the State Housing Appeal Board. And so they would basically put the legal burden, this bill would, on the municipalities to show how they, you know, a proposal would actually be harmful to them in order to deny an appeal. So it sort of tilts the scale a little bit more in favor of the developer affordable housing advocates. And proponents say the idea is not necessarily to get a flood of appeals coming into the system, but basically just to sort of put the fear of God proverbially into the suburbs to show that there actually will be consequences, or at least could, if they don't submit these plans and actually work on them.
So that is what this proposed update to the Affordable Housing Planning and Appeal Act, that's kind of what it would encompass. And I know Governor Pritzker, you mentioned this, was really putting forth a series of housing legislation that was being debated. But the governor, you know, and this was to the dismay of some housing advocates, I mean, he was kind of saying, pump the brakes a little bit. He was saying, we got to be cautious with this. What was his concern?
Yeah, it was interesting because this is one of the proposals that was in a state commissioned report alongside a lot of the other reforms that ended up in the build plan. It has a lot of the same proponents as the proponents of the build plan. The difference is that this particular, the APA bill, would include, it would call for some extra spending by the state that was not included in the governor's budget. Granted, it is $300,000 for administrative capacity of hiring a couple more people to the Illinois Housing Development Authority, IDA, that regulates this. And $300,000, when you're talking about a $56 billion budget, is not a whole lot. But nonetheless, this was the statement that came out of the governor's administration basically saying, well, hold on, we haven't identified a funding source for this yet. So whether this could end up getting lumped in with the other bills, we don't know. I mean, one other thing to note, even though the APA bill was not included in the governor's package, unlike those other bills that were included in the governor's package, the APA bill has actually made it farther through the legislature already. It passed the House back in April and has picked up a whole lot of pretty high-profile sponsors in the Senate. And so it is closer to the finish line, at least on paper, than a lot of those Pritzker-backed housing proposals are.
And I wanted to talk to you about that finish line. We know that the legislative session wrapped up about a week ago. And so what happened with this proposed update to this Affordable Housing Planning and Appeal Act? Where did this end up?
It is still sitting in committee in the Senate. And we'll just have to see, you know, during either the veto session or the lame duck session, whether it comes back up and gets another hearing and gets a vote. I mean, what happened to it is essentially what happened to all of this other housing production legislation that we're talking about, which is just that the resistance from mayors, the resistance from mayors in wealthy communities that don't want to have to build more housing, was just enough to really throw sand in the gears and stop these bills in their tracks. It seems like there was a lot of movement on them. There were new versions that were filed in the Senate and amendments filed, and it seemed like things were starting to come together, but it just ran out of time. And so it's back on the governor and it's back on housing advocates to try to, rev up their advocacy and see if something can come crashing together in veto session, like, say, the big transit bill did in veto session last year.
And something like this, you mentioned that this bill has really, you know, what we're talking about here has gotten further along than a lot of the other housing proposals. But what we're talking about here, the impact on the larger conversation about affordable housing. Again, I said that we're in an affordable housing crisis here. So is this, do you think, going to be sort of inspirational? Are housing advocates really going to come back? You mentioned what could happen in the veto session and the lame duck session. But I mean, is this really inspiring housing advocates to get back at it?
Yeah, it possibly. I mean, maybe advocates would see this as sort of lower hanging fruit. Like they just have to get to those key senators who are standing in the way and get it passed through the Senate so that it can go to the governor's desk. It's quite possible. I mean, we're now getting to a point where, yeah, advocates for some of these bills might have to sort of pick and choose their battles to see what they can get across.
We will see what happens. And I know, Alex, that you will be covering all the action in Springfield. And look, with all of the talk of what was going on with the Chicago Bears, sometimes this housing issue, which is super important, gets lost in the shuffle.
That's
so
right.
I'm glad you are keeping an eye on this. And we can go to illinoisanswers.org if we would like to check out what Alex and all of his colleagues over at the Illinois Answers Project are writing. That is a nonpartisan independent news organization published by the Better Government Association. And Alex Nitkin is an investigative reporter at the Illinois Answers Project. Hey, Alex, I always appreciate your time and your reporting. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And that'll do it. Outside the Loop show number 1025 is done. Thank you very much for listening to the show today. Thanks, of course, to the great Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering help in the WGN Radio studio. I hope you have a wonderful week. I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop. We'll be right back.